Hello, everyone. It's March 5th, 2024. And would you know it? We're talking about the IM-1 mission one last time. We have some news on that off-nominal landing, not just speculation this time. This is the episode where we answer the questions we were asking last episode. So let's close out the IM-1 miniseries and lift off. And we've cleared the tower. Welcome to episode 449 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Dennis. And I've got some shuttle trivia.
Okay.
All right. It's been a while. But I thought this was a pretty fun one. It's also a numeric guess one. We're not going to do Price's Right rules. It's just whoever gets closer. But we all know there's been 135 shuttle missions. How many of them took off on their very first launch attempt?
Oh, you mean with no delays?
With no delays.
Five?
Yeah.
Five.
So you're talking about like...
When the crew climbed in, they got to go to space that same day. Yeah. So maybe they got delayed an hour, you know, whatever. But like,
it's
they didn't have
like 75. Like, I'm thinking it's like, no, it can't be that much more than half.
Yeah, I have no idea. I'll say 70. And that's a number I'm getting out of nowhere.
Okay. Well, Ben, the fact that, you know, pre-show you said that, oh, I'm probably going to do terrible with the trivia. You, of course, did a phenomenal job. It was actually 76.
Ah,
so both of you. I mean, David, you bracketed it correctly and everything.
Oh, wait a minute. How many did you say, Ben?
I said 75.
I didn't even hear you say that because I picked 70, like literally just because I picked it out of nowhere. I didn't even know you said so. Okay, so I guess we were both somewhere in the ballpark. And then you pretty much nailed it.
Yeah,
you were 52%. I was 56%. And yeah, off I went. Wow, that's pretty cool.
So they were, yeah, exactly. They were about, you know, 50% of them. The flights they had to, yeah, basically scrub and launch another day.
Wait, now I gotta do the math and figure out how far off I was.
Less than a percent.
I was off by 3/4%. Mm. Yeah. 0.74. Awesome. So 3/4%.
Good job. And that was just going on instinct, right?
Yeah. I feel like listening to the space above us prepared me for that one.
Okay. There you go. In the news, the last big IM-1 update. This will be the last one for like, what, a while, but it's not the last.
Yeah, we might do another update when it dies, especially because they are saving up all their electricity so they can do one big data dump when they have a really good view of the Earth and they can actually use their high gain. And we might do a short and sweet, but I don't think it's going to be big enough to be a main topic. So mm-hmm. When I say last big, I'm talking about like on this show, this is probably the last time that we're going to feature them. Just cause we've done three main topics for IM-1.
Well, speaking of, I don't think it happened as early as our last recording, but Slim is still alive. Did we talk about that?
I don't think we mentioned it, but yeah.
So it can survive at least one lunar night, maybe several. I don't know, but I mean, that's pretty cool.
Has it already gone through a lunar night? Mm-hmm. Wow. Man, 2 weeks goes by fast.
I know.
That's
right?
Really cool.
Yeah. And then I think it went right back to sleep, if I remember the reporting correctly.
It looks like it was, well, so according to one article from CNN, it looks like it was, I think, told to kind of go back to sleep just because it was in high temperatures because this was during the lunar midday.
Oh, yes. I remember that now. Exactly. Yeah. So evidently it didn't wake up. Yeah. Like the moment the, you know, lunar night ended, I guess.
But preparations are being made to resume operations once the temperatures come down. So that's kind of funny that it's just because it's too hot at the moment, not that it's too cold or dark.
Go figure.
So anyway, yeah, we kind of got sidetracked on Slim there, but where do we leave off with the IM-1? Yeah, and so remember how I was kind of confused as to why it didn't stick that landing. So, Ben, do you have a explanation as to why that happened? Which, you know, kind of makes sense now that I'm hearing about it.
Yeah. So we that's what the big news is. Like, hey, we found out why it crashed. So as a reminder, when they were getting ready to land, they wound up turning on their landing radar and it found out that they had not enabled it when it was on the ground. So it was missing the circuitry the wire hookup that allowed them to turn it on and off. So that's out of the picture. They decided to do like one or two orbits so that they had enough time to bring on one of the NASA payloads, the Navigation Doppler LiDAR for precise velocity and range sensing, which is a science instrument, but they were able to enable it and use it as a navigation instrument. Very, very cool. And so they had to actually write code to get it to interface with their systems, which like makes sense, but it's still shocking to me that like they wrote all of this. And it turns out that they wrote almost all of it, but missed one flag in their software, I believe. And so their navigation computer was not able to read the data in real time. So it was basically invalid for the purposes of being able to land. The data was basically marked as invalid. And so when they were actually doing the landing, they effectively had no altimeter, not their native radar, which they say if they would have had, they would have landed perfectly. And I don't see any reason that that shouldn't be the case. They did not have NASA's hacked in LiDAR. And so the only thing that they had telling them how high above the surface they were their cameras, which, you know, are supposed to be used for hazard avoidance and terrain relative navigation. And they just didn't have those up and running, or they didn't have the precision that they need to do a real, you know, accurate landing. So when they came in, you know, they had an idea of where they were. And by they, I mean the computer on board. But it was off by 100 meters. It thought that it was 100 meters higher in altitude than it actually was. And so when they hit the surface, instead of having no lateral movement at all and descending slowly at 1 meter per second, they hit the ground going 3 meters per second vertically and 2 meters per second laterally. And so that, I mean, that's a pretty hard hit if, you know, that's not what your vehicle is designed for. And so they didn't, it sounds like they didn't actually hit a rock. Rather, they snapped one of their legs off as they're going sideways. And then, you know, they're basically dragging their face through the regolith. And they wound up building up a little bit. It sounds like a little pile of dirt that they're leaning on. They're also on a pretty steep slope. And so last week, the best guess was the thing was on level ground with all four of its legs intact, and it had tipped over and its head was resting on a rock. But instead, it's on sort of a slope and one of its legs is snapped so that the whole body can be up against the regolith. But they have gotten data back from every one of NASA's payloads so far. The stereoscopic imager that looks at the ground is not working. They expect that it was damaged because, you know, it's really low down on the lander. They expect that payload was damaged. And so it doesn't sound like they're very hopeful about getting data back from it. And so last week we were really excited that they were going to try to pop Eagle Cam out and get some photos of the thing laying on the surface. And they did eject Eagle Cam, but either Eagle Cam did not work or the Wi-Fi network that they used to talk to Eagle Cam didn't work. So they don't have images. Maybe they'll be able to get images, you know, maybe Eagle Cam will be able to keep power and temperature up high enough, that, you know, when they get the Wi-Fi working, they'll be able to get images from it. Or maybe they won't. It's not clear what the issue is. And it's also not clear if they're actually going to try and fix their Wi-Fi. So we'll find out. But for right now, no third-person photos, which is a real bummer if you ask me.
I also heard it was just because it wasn't meant to deploy in that sideways orientation. So
I mean, that too.
So it didn't snag on a rock when it landed. So as I recall, they did register a pretty rapid change in...
Yeah, that might have been the leg breaking.
But if it hadn't landed, why would the leg breaking cause it to shift or rotate?
Well, I don't know if that sudden jerk was before or after they actually landed. Yeah, they may have interpreted it as post-landing or pre-landing and then realized, oh, actually that was post. But, I mean, who knows? I can only guess.
That was a good update, though, because people were getting real hot and bothered about them, you know. Oh, they're not being forthcoming enough. It's like, I don't know. They seem fine.
Yeah, it's space. Like, this is the way it works.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm getting a lot of information from them. Sorry they're not putting out a tweet, like, you know, within 5 minutes of whatever anomaly happens, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It would be weird if you were getting information so quickly, because how would they do that? Like, it takes time to figure this stuff out.
And especially with Intuitive Machines, the week that they had, right? They were in space for like 10 days. It was like a 10-day mission, and they had like 11 crises. is what was quoted in the Ars Technica article that we'll link in the show notes. Pretty tough. Like this is not an easy, not an easy thing to do. The Ars Technica article also mentioned like their office is just full of like candy bar wrappers and, chip bags. Just like they have been hammering away at problem after problem. So yeah, of course they don't have a ton of time left over for PR, and they also don't feel super able to stop working and switch over. Like, yeah.
And the fact that you have to use the plural for a crisis kind of tells you what we're dealing with.
Yeah. And like, I'm sure at some point somebody's also going to start moaning about like whether or not it's a good use of money to have somebody doing this. And like, obviously you at this point, you can't go to the moon successfully unless you are funded by a government. And at this point, the best organization to go to a moon or a planet is an organization like NASA in the 1960s, maybe in the, you know, 70s and 80s too, a little bit, but like, yeah, it's really tough. But like the more I read about this, the more impressed I was. Like, they actually really did do a good job. And so hopefully we're going to see a private company succeed at this. I still would much rather prefer funding NASA at reasonable rates, but yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, people have the feeling of like, you know, why is it so hard to land on the moon? Weren't we doing this back in the 60s? It's like, okay, give Intuitive Machines five times the budget, you know, three times the amount of staff, and yeah, they'll actually land for like, you know, perfectly, probably, you know,
and
just throw enough money and time at it.
Yeah, how much do you have to multiply their risk tolerance as well? NASA never lost somebody on the moon, but that's actually a lot of luck responsible for that. Like, we would not accept the same risk assessments today.
They did so well on this particular mission here that if they do another, which they will, they'll probably nail it. You just have to do it enough times, and then it does actually bring the cost down. I mean, putting people on the moon is different, but as far as a lunar lander, I mean, at least if you use the same lander.
Right.
I think it'll get a lot easier from this point forward, at least with all these new landers. It's kind of all being worked out, and we're kind of, you know, like entering a new age of putting things on the moon, and I think it'll just be significantly easier.
Yeah, just think about how much experience they have from this, right? They're going to be seasoned when IM2 launches.
Right. I mean, they learned so much from this. I just get the sense that they will nail it the next time. So let's just do two short and sweets this week. Dennis, what is the first one?
Orion has hatch problems. NASA has been evaluating a number of issues regarding the Orion spacecraft's side hatch. There are no details yet, only that these issues may affect contingency operations in off-nominal situations on the launch pad or after splashdown. However, there has been a reference to a, quote, delta pressure capacity issue. This and other potential problems are reportedly due to the hatch's design, and thus redesigns are being considered. Full-scale testing is currently being carried out to evaluate more precisely what changes may be required.
And then next up, ISRO plans for Mars helicopter. So they're going to do their own now. ISRO is now planning its own helicopter for Mars exploration. So far, it is only in the conceptual stage, but will carry several instruments. The Mars copter will be capable of flying up to 100 meters, allowing it to gather a detailed vertical profile of Martian atmospheric characteristics in the near-surface boundary layers of Mars. The rotorcraft is expected to be part of the follow-up mission to Mongolia, where it will accompany the lander down to the surface. Okay, so let's move on then to This Week in Spaceflight History. Just three correct guesses. We have Chris S, and then we have two other correct guesses with the bonus points for Sakhail and Dennis O. And the clue was the first 10-person spaceflight. And I figured this was one of these tricky clues. I mean, I guess they all are, but we know that there's not a 10-person at once spaceflight, right? Or at least launch or landing. So what is this 10-person spaceflight?
Well, it was a 10-person spaceflight on the 8th of March, 2001. And, there is some tricky accounting going on here. And so, this event, like I said, 8th of March, 2001, this was the launch of STS-102. It was a fairly straightforward and uneventful mission, but there were a lot of firsts, including, well, to basically give the clue, is this was the first crew rotation on the International Space Station. So there had been missions to the station, like for resupply and things like that, which is what this was. It was a resupply mission, as well as starting to assemble it. But this was the first time that this was the end of Expedition 1 and the beginning of Expedition 2, so the first time that they needed to hand it over. And so even though the space shuttle could only fit seven people, well, it's only designed to fit seven people, they did launch that one mission with eight people, and then when they had for contingencies and they could put a special pallet in the mid deck and try to bring 10 people back on a single go, which is pretty cool, but not this one. And so it launched with seven people, and then it landed with a different set of seven people for 10 in all. And so I guess when it comes to shuttle missions, it's like, do you mention the crew? And in this case, since, the clue is, a 10-person spaceflight, I might as well talk about everybody. So the commander is Jim Weatherby. And this isn't – I always think this is pretty cool about shuttles. Like, there was just so many missions and so many people. Like, maybe if you're, a really big shuttle geek, you would know that person's name. But otherwise, Jim Weatherby is like, who's this guy? The guy flew to space six times on the shuttle, and he was the commander for five different shuttle missions. So he's kind of like a pretty big deal, right? that's pretty badass. And Jim Weatherby, he was the commander of this mission, which was his fifth of six. So he wasn't even done after this. He would fly again. And he flew with the pilot for this mission was James Kelly. Not related to Mark or Scott Kelly, but he has one of my favorite nicknames of all the shuttle pilots, Vegas Kelly. Yeah, he flew again, but also as pilot. I think with Eileen Collins was his next flight, and so he never actually commanded his own mission. But going to space twice, sitting in the cockpit's pretty good. And then in the mission specialist one role was Andy Thomas, who is an Australian American. If you read about Mir, then you might recognize him as the last person on the Shuttle Mir program, and so he was the final American to be on that. That space station. And then in the MS-2 role, which is also the flight engineer, so they kind of sit in between the commander and pilot, and if there's an abort to orbit, for example, they have an important role, but they have an important role always on these missions to kind of act as like a third person to help out the two pilots that are actually flying the plane. And that was Paul Richards. This was his first and only flight, but a pretty good one to be a part of. And then you had the three people of Expedition 2 that were getting dropped off. And so you had Yuri Usachev, who was the Russian member of Expedition 2, and he would take over as the commander of the space station once he was left there. And then Jim Voss and Susan Helms rounded it out. And so they also did some spacewalks on this mission, and Susan Helms just had her birthday last week, as Chubby pointed out in the chat during last week's recording. And so happy belated, Susan. And so those were the seven people that came up, and they went and met with the Expedition 1 crew, which was commanded by Bill Shepard, who, as I understand, was a very, very tough no-nonsense Marine. and with him on Expedition 1 were two Russian cosmonauts, Yuri Gudzenko and Sergei Krikalev. So Sergei Krikalev shows up in the news nowadays sometimes when Russian spaceflight does something stupid. you tend to hear him basically trying to, you know, smooth over it and, you know, oh, no, it's okay. We're not actually, you know, he tries to be, he seems like a voice of reason, I think, in Roscosmos. That's just my own personal opinion. But yeah. And so Bill Shepard, Yuri Gudzenko, and Sergei Krikalev were going to be brought down on the return of this shuttle mission. And so that makes 10 people in all. And so the launch was uneventful. Every like anomaly on this mission was like, you know, some goofy little thing, like, you know, a microphone wasn't quite working, or, you know, one of the CRT monitors was being a little glitchy. There was nothing serious that happened. It was pretty good. So I figure, like, you know, what do I want to talk about for this launch if nothing happened? Is that I think it's pretty neat to know that initially, shuttle missions, and this is true also for like all the crewed flight before shuttle, like so Mercury, you know, and Gemini and Apollo, you would basically fly with your head aimed towards the ground. So you basically flew upside down once you got, you know, that tried to build up that sideways velocity. My understanding, the reason for that in general was that it just was a better view of the horizon. Rather than be right side up, like if you were actually flying a plane, right? And so by being upside down, you just had a better view of the horizon and the ground, and you could orient yourself better. And so that's how the shuttle missions used to fly until I had this in my internal notes, like STS 87 or 89, I'm not sure which. But at that point, then the shuttle at around Mach 13 would actually roll to heads up. And so it would fly right side up after, you know, 5 minutes and 50 seconds or so. And so they did that, you know, on this mission, obviously, since it was after STS 87 or 88. So if you always had that picture of the shuttle flying right side up, you know, into during like orbit insertion, that wasn't true for, you know, most of the shuttle missions. It was only, you know, after 87 or 88, STS 87 or 88 or 89 that it would roll to heads up.
So I know that it, at least I think that it was in the heads down position, right? Just because it needed to maintain communication with ground, right?
I bet that, oh, that's a good point. I'm sure that was part of it. And I believe the aerodynamics, like the airframe of the orbiter was designed that when it was going through the sensible part of the atmosphere, that it was designed to be upside down. And so they couldn't fly the other way, yeah, right side up through the thick parts of the atmosphere. That's why they had to be above most of it.
So this is even like after booster separation, right? It would still be in the heads down position?
So booster sep, it would be heads down, and then it would still have the ET attached, I believe, when it did the roll to heads up.
That makes sense, because you have to push that tank up into space along with you, right? Like you can't really, I mean, I could just be wrong here, but it doesn't seem to make any kind of intuitive sense to be in a heads up position sitting on top of the tank.
You can do it. It's all about the aerodynamic forces on the wings and the tail. But you could certainly do the entire ascent right side up if you really wanted to. Like assuming that the wings aren't going to be stressed beyond their limits. There's no like rocketry reason why you can't.
First of all, I definitely don't think it would be able to generate that kind of lift. But
yeah, it's not like you're going to be getting lift off of it. But
yeah, believe it or not, there's a wonderful article, and it's a short read, and it turns out it's pretty great. But basically, they didn't realize during the initial design, like basically they kind of ran into trouble. They were like, oh boy, the loads on the wings are going to be too much for the orbiter. What do we do? And they basically came up with some changes, which also included the flight profile, and then also having the surfaces, the aero surfaces, I guess. You see them actually move, like the ailerons during ascent, and that's not any control of like the space plane or the stack or anything. That's solely to manage the loads on the orbiter.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Why the Wings Stay On by Ehrlich. It's a short read. I recommend everybody check it out. Oh, and David, yeah, sorry. There was a point you made. I think that's great. I'm pretty sure that more than like, even though orientation was, you know, at least that was why Mercury, you know, the early missions wanted to do heads down, but I'm pretty sure that it was communication, and that would be why after STS 87 or 89, we had enough Tedrises, and like it didn't matter anymore. And so I think you're spot on with that. Yeah.
So it's like heads down for Earth, and then once you're in orbit ish, heads up for Tedris.
Mm-hmm. And so they got to station, and yeah, everything kind of went well. They did a pair of EVAs. And so Jim Voss and Susan Helms did the first. And it was actually the longest EVA ever that is still true as of today, our recording on March 3rd, 2024. And so it was 8 hours, 55 minutes, and 56 seconds. And I didn't see any description of, like, why it was so long. Things basically went well, and I believe they accomplished all their tasks except for one, which they just then moved to the second EVA of the mission. There were two in total. But, like, it wasn't like I didn't read that, oh, they were stuck on – this bolt was stuck, and that basically took, you know, 2 hours, or they ran into some kind of, you know, terrible anomaly, and that's why it was drawn out. It just seemed like, hey, we're here. We're basically supporting the fledgling International Space Station. And so if you've got the endurance for almost 9 hours for a 9 hour spacewalk, then just go for it. And so they did, which is pretty awesome. And yeah, and the second EVA was Andy Thomas and Paul Richards, the other American mission specialists. They did that one. So even though, like I said before, Paul Richards, this was his one and only flight. Pretty cool, pretty good flight to get to, you know, sit in the MS-2 seat and also to do an EVA. Although it wasn't almost 9 hours, but it was a more normal one. And the EVAs were just, you know, installing external platforms, doing some cabling. They were prepping for Canadarm2 eventually to get onto the station. There was a picture I found because they did bring a integrated cargo carrier. This was the fourth time the ICC flew, which is right, basically just this, you know, this grid, this pallet that you could stick stuff on. And unfortunately, well, fortunately or not, is all a matter of perspective. But there's a great picture during processing that shows Voss and Usachev and Helms, along with some other technicians, posing in front of one of the ICCs. And you can definitely see Estrella crane directly behind them on the ICC. But I don't believe that crane actually flew on STS-102. And so it was brought to orbit, I guess, on a different resupply mission. But yeah, like that's definitely Estrella sitting right there. And so the EVAs were both uneventful. Otherwise, the rest of the mission involved using the shuttle's RMS, its robot arm, to do different tasks. And so they relocated PMA-3, right, the pressurized mating adapter. They moved it from the nadir of Unity to its port side, just to prepare for future modules and whatnot. And also to, I believe, at the nadir of Unity is where they then would stick the multipurpose logistics module, MPLM. And so this was the first time an MPLM had flown. It was Leonardo in particular. They had different names, right? Leonardo, Raphael, clearly named after the Ninja Turtles and not named after Renaissance people that the Ninja Turtles were named after. But yeah. Yeah, the which Leonardo is the one that's now permanently affixed to the station. And I learned some new things about it just watching footage of the mission. And one, I didn't know that it has a window, which is pretty neat. I had no idea. And two, it is really spacious. I mean, if you were to go and look at, like, you know, these more recent tours of the ISS, it doesn't look spacious because it's filled with stuff. But when it's pretty empty, like, I'm talking, like, it gives me a Skylab vibes, like how big it is. Like, it is quite large.
Yeah, when you don't have racks in the U.S., like the standard module, when you don't have the racks in there, it is really like cavernous. Yeah,
it's big.
That is big. Oh, and you were right about Estrella. So I looked up, apparently the mission before this one on STS-101, the shuttle brought up Estrella.
Oh, no kidding. That's cool. And I guess they did their thing. Everything went well. And, you know, they ended by, again, taking the Expedition 1 crew over. I guess this was also the first time that bell was rung when you had the changing of the crews. And I was thinking before I knew I was going to give trivia at the top of this episode, I wanted to do some trivia now, although this one is much more manageable. All right. I want to see on the spot, you guys, this was the change from Expedition 1 to Expedition 2. What expedition are we currently on?
Oh, I feel like you asked this before. or maybe it was about something else.
I quizzed you about how many X-planes there have been.
What really sucks is that we're about to see, or we just had a dragon bring new people up. So I know I've seen the number within the last week. I don't know. I think it's in the 50s.
I'm going to go with my answer for the first one, 70.
You're kidding. I think it is 70. Let me just double check. Yeah, it's Expedition 70. Good job.
All right.
Nailed it. Okay, so Ben nailed it at the top of the show, and you got this one. So good job, team. So anyway, they you know, once they had the you know, they brought, you know, Bill Shepard and Sergei Krikalev and Yuri Gudzenko, because they had been on orbit for a while, so they needed to be in kind of reclined seats in the mid-deck. And yeah, they undocked from the station. They did a fly around, 1.25 laps around the station, and then headed back home to Earth. And they had to waive the first landing opportunity because of rain showers in the area. But then they landed fine, 12 days and 19 hours after taking off. And that was this week in spaceflight history.
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, so next week is the 12th to the 18th of March. David, do you have a clue for us?
Yes, I do. So the clue is for next week in 1966, a 154-day mission, but only for the passengers.
Okay, mm-hmm. So we went from 10 passengers to mission duration.
Yeah.
All right, if you have a guess as to what this clue is referencing, email us at info@theorbitalmechanics.com or shoot us a tweet on Mastodon, use the hashtag ThisWeekSF, or visit theorbitalmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server. Good luck.
Good luck. So let's move along then to upcoming spaceflight events. It's got 5 events. Looks like 4 launches, I believe. What's the first launch, Ben?
All right. First up is a Falcon 9 Block 5 launching Starlink Group 642. This is flying out of Slick 40 at the Cape sometime between Friday, March 8th at 0119 hours and 0450 hours UTC.
And after that, we have the launch of Kairos, and that is being launched by Space One. This is the, looks like it's its first flight for a Japanese government cabinet, or it's a Japanese government cabinet satellite, and looks like it's some kind of a Japanese spy sat. So that's interesting. The window for that is from 0200 UTC through 0300 UTC from Spaceport Key in Japan from Space One launch pad.
And then we have our only non-launch event of the week. On March 9th, we have coverage of the ISS change of command ceremony. And so this will be on NASA TV at 9:35 a.m. Eastern. Crew 7 will be giving their farewell remarks. And then Andreas Mogensen will hand over command of the station to Oleg Kononenko, who is the longest duration on orbit of anybody semi-recently. He passed that, and he'll be, right, we talked, he'll get to 1,000 days, basically, before he comes home. So, but now he'll be commander.
After that is an Electron flying Owl Night Long. And now I've got Daft Punk in my head. This mission is flying.
I got Lionel Richie in my head.
Okay, there you go. So this mission is flying Strix 3, which is a synthetic aperture radar observatory for the Japanese company Synspective. This is going to be flying out of the Mahia Peninsula, as you would expect, sometime on Saturday, March 9th, between 1400 hours and 1500 hours UTC.
And then finally, we have a Falcon 9 Block 5, and that's launching CRS-2, which is SpaceX 30. So this is another commercial resupply mission to the ISS. The launch time for that is at 2447 UTC, launching from Slick 40 at the Cape.
All right, so those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
All right, which means it's time to do over the show, and we would like to thank Ron Jenkins and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
We record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Thank you so much to Chubby, Dennis O, Mr. Cesium, Mike Ryan, the Great Colin, Chris S., and Vax Headroom for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction burns on the fly.
If you want to support the show, please tell a friend, or better yet, leave us a review wherever you listen. And thank you to Paps or Groovy for the 5-star view. You can also visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign and affiliate links.
Get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about. Or you can skip all of that by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
So that's it. We'll see you all in orbit next week. Until then, later.
Bye, everybody.
See you.